Our last case of the morning is number 022016, the United States against John Johnson. Mr. McGowan. Suppose we let opposing counsel get settled for a minute, okay?
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Andrew J. McGowan, and I'm with the Federal Defender for the Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellant in this case, John Johnson. Mr. Johnson appeals from the district court's ruling that it was not required to order Mr. Johnson's federal sentence for distribution of crack cocaine to run concurrently with a previously imposed state court sentence for conspiracy to distribute 900 grams of cocaine. Now, the guidelines require that if the prior drug amounts were fully taken into account in the federal sentence, that those sentences run concurrently. And there's no dispute about whether, if they are considered relevant conduct, that they should run concurrently. However, there is a dispute about whether the amount in the state court case was relevant conduct in this federal case. And as the court's well aware from the briefs, there are two different evaluations that this court has applied in this kind of situation to determine whether something's relevant conduct or not. Those are under the guidelines. One's called a common scheme or plan, and the other's called a common course of conduct. And they have their various parts of the test. For the common scheme or plan, there has to be some sort of common accomplices or common purpose or common modus operandi. And really, that standard only requires one of those particular commonalities. And I would submit that based on the facts contained in the brief and the facts that I can reiterate here, that we've established a common purpose and, in fact, have established that there were common parties involved, accomplices, and that the modus operandi was similar.
How do we deal with the standard of review issue here, Mr. McGowan? After all, this is a very fact-based kind of an assessment by a district court, and that does pose some problems, I think, for you.
Thank you. Your Honor, the standard of review is an issue in this case. The government has argued that the standard review should be clear error, and for a factual determination, I believe the government would be correct. However, I believe that there are no facts in dispute in this case. There were no facts in dispute in the district court, and I believe that there are no facts in dispute before this court. There is a question about what I would consider a legal determination that the government has raised, and that legal determination is whether there was the facts before the district court on the relevant conduct that Mr. Johnson was dealing between the time of his state court case and this case, whether those amounted to speculation. And I believe that that's more of a legal determination than a factual determination. And as this court has observed in many cases, the difference between a factual and legal determination may be not as obvious as it could be. However, in this case, I believe that we're not arguing about the facts.
Well, then where did the district court misstep? Where did he fall down?
You know, I don't know that the district court actually, in my evaluation of the district court's ruling, I didn't see him take into account Mr. Johnson's statements.
But they're unsworn, self-serving statements that were made under a grant of immunity.
Some of them were. One of them was made to a confidential informant when he didn't even know he was being recorded. And I don't know if it was recorded, but certainly observed by the confidential informant. And in fact, the statements to the confidential informant were that I'm out on the state court case, I'm going to do some time, and I am going to continue to deal drugs until I get put in jail on it because I'm making too much money. And that's attributed to my client. It's certainly something that could be corroborated by the number of recordings of this confidential informant and the government while he's being investigated for this federal case. And I think it's corroborated by Mr. Johnson's statements. And the fact is, Mr. Johnson's statements can be held against him much more easily than somebody else's statements about what Mr. Johnson was doing or what he's saying. I don't think there's really a credibility problem here. I suppose the district court could have said he found Mr. Johnson not credible. However, The district court relied on the information provided by the agent who testified over several hours at the hearing. The agent identified that he'd spoken with Mr. Johnson for several hours and had written two reports of these proffer sessions and found Mr. Johnson to be credible. So I don't believe that there's a credibility determination here that the district court missed. I believe that the district court relied on the government's representation that this wasn't relevant conduct.
What was his rationale for allowing half the sentence to run concurrently?
Your Honor, he did have discretion, even under anybody's standard here, to make it either fully concurrent, partially concurrent, or fully consecutive. And his rationale was bifurcated, and in fact, I don't recall exactly what he said, but I think it had in part to do with the government's need for Mr. Johnson further on down the road. And I believe it was tied into that. In fact, he said, if you continue to cooperate as you've said you would, then it looks like you're going to get a break anyway. But I'm not going to give you the whole break here. And I hope that answers that particular question. But in any event, again, there are no credibility determinations that I see. I don't know why the district court ruled why it did the way it did, although the district court did seem disturbed that there were not specific facts of specific drug dealing. I think that's the best way I can characterize that. And in fact, some of the cases I've cited do include particular facts about particular deals other than the two that we have in here. However, I'm relying on rather broader statements to find relevant conduct, and those broad statements include my client admitting to the agents that he'd been dealing heavily for over a year. The proffer letters, of course, as the court has seen before in other cases, tend to be, you tell the truth. I don't want you to minimize. I don't want you to exaggerate. So I don't know that it was simply a self-serving statement. In fact, it could have been used against him probably in the state court later on. I would just like to comment, too, that one of the factors that the government doesn't believe is important and the district court relied on pretty significantly is that the fact that Mr. Johnson's source, Jeffrey Bullock, was incarcerated, and after his incarceration, he wasn't able to use him as a source. I believe he was incarcerated in November of 2000. However, a few months later, Mr. Bullock, or we don't know exactly when, but Mr. Bullock did initiate a new source for my client, Tony. And so my client continued to deal with Tony just as he had dealt with Mr. Bullock before Mr. Bullock was incarcerated. The Zem opinion that I've cited in my brief does include as a factor a situation similar where a source was put in jail and then it was continued through another source that was introduced, I believe, from the earlier source. Otherwise, Your Honor, I would rely on the arguments and facts contained in my brief, and I would reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. We'll hear now from Mr. Bruce.
Morning. May it please the Court, Colin Bruce on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, I feel this argument is a little anticlimactic after the earlier Thomas the Train Engine and the clicky-clack track. Unfortunately, I don't have any toys I can present. The government in this case simply asks that you affirm the judgment and conviction in this case. Stated quite simply, the district court was not clearly erroneous when it concluded the earlier 1999 conspiracy involving the defendant, Mr. Bullock, and Mr. Wilson was not related to the 2000 sale by Mr. Johnson and a relative of his, Terrence Johnson, of some 3 ounces of crack in exchange for a car. Actually, only sold 1 ounce of crack. The deal was for 3 ounces. Stated quite simply, the defendant simply wants to include all this as relevant conduct because it will allow him to effectively eliminate any federal sentence he gets. Basically, it would mean that he was able to commit an offense in 1999 and then commit one or more additional offenses, certainly the one in a 2000, and receive no punishment. Judge Ripple, in answer to your question regarding why the split sentence, if I can just go to that for a moment, I believe the split sentence was imposed because, as Mr. McGowan indicated, there's hope that Mr. Johnson will receive an additional reduction in sentence. I don't think the judge felt it appropriate at this time to essentially reward Mr. Johnson for all of his activities, all his cooperation, right up front. I quickly skimmed the transcript after your question. There's some reference in there by Judge McCuskey about wanting to keep a handle on him. I think he even says to Mr. Johnson, 35 months concurrent, 35 months consecutive, and then 35, and then remember, a rule 35 is what he says, 35, 35, and 35. Your Honors, quite simply, the uncharged conduct we're discussing, the 1999 conspiracy involving Mr. Wilson and Mr. Bullock, as well as Mr. Johnson, which involved kilos of powder cocaine and pounds of marijuana, which took place in July and August of 1999, was neither part of a common scheme or plan or part of the same course of conduct as Mr. Johnson's crack cocaine sale in 2000 involving a different individual. Very briefly, under the guidelines for a common scheme or plan, you have to have, as the guidelines indicate and the case law indicates, the same accomplices, either participants and typically in the same type of roles, same victims, same purposes, or same modus operandi for the same course of conduct. The nature of the offense has to be the same. It has to be part of a regular pattern of criminal activity. And that third factor is the closeness in time.
Under the facts of this particular case, Mr. Bruce, who had the burden of showing that the state case, in fact, was relevant conduct?
I believe in this case the burden of proof would have been on the defendant to show by preponderance of the evidence that the prior conspiracy conviction was related to the 2000 sale. I think Judge Rovner touched on it very briefly when she asked about the immunized statements. You know, interestingly, I think when you read the transcript, you can see originally Judge McCuskey basically wants to know why this whole, all this activity wasn't charged in a multi-count indictment in federal court. And he says, you know, if the parties don't call Agent Stolitz, who's a case agent from Decatur, the judge is going to call Agent Stolitz to ask him. So we go through a chronology of the development of the case. When Agent Stolitz is on the stand, Mr. McGowan asks him some questions about the reports, but specifically Judge Rovner, there was no exploration of the statements made by Mr. Johnson. Simply, you know, he made some statements, yes, they're mostly truthful, yes, and that's it. No exploration, no details. Nothing further. So essentially in the record there is nothing to support the gap between the end of the 1999 conspiracy with Wilson and Bullock and the 2000 transaction. Even setting aside that they're not related, not the same type, involve totally different people, different purpose, different roles, etc. Even setting all that aside, there's still absolutely no continuity there as well. So for those reasons, Your Honor, Your Honors, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment and conviction in this case. And I'll return the balance of my time unless the court has any further questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. Mr. McGowan, you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I would just note for the record that the government argues again, as it argued below, that he wouldn't receive any punishment for this federal offense if he didn't get sentenced to some time consecutively. Well, that's not necessarily what the law requires. The law simply requires that under certain circumstances, the judge must make the federal sentence concurrent to the state sentence. I would admit that in this case, the defense bore the burden. It's simply whoever is presenting the argument has the burden. I believe that that's what the case law says. In terms of the exploration of Mr. Johnson's statements, I don't know that would have been necessary or would have elaborated much more than Agent Stolitz testifying simply that he had met with him, he had written a report about him, and that he found him credible. Thank you, Your Honor. For these reasons, we ask you to remand for the district court with instructions to have him resentenced at a lower sentence and concurrent, or a slightly higher sentence and concurrently to his state court sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Thank you, Mr. Bruce. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court has finished the call of the day, and therefore the court will rise until the date appointed for oral arguments next week.